Well, ladies, I'd particularly like to talk about our role as Christian women in our society. I think many of us are feeling quite confused and worried about this, and I find more and more of my Christian women friends are tending to withdraw from society and say that we now live in a completely secular society, and the modern laws that have been passed recently, the Anti-Discrimination Act, which was just passed a little while ago, and I'd like to say something about it, and the Family Law Act, are completely non-Christian laws. They are laws of a secular society, which completely ignore the values that we hold most highly. So that I find a lot of Christian women saying, well, look, we know what we believe, we know what we think is the right way to bring up our families and to live our lives, and we must keep our children from getting involved in what's happening in society. But that is completely impossible. And the more we try to do that, the more we antagonise our children. So that we have to look at this society around us. And I think now it's very obvious to us all that we are not of this society. We have to live in it. But because of our beliefs and because we put God above all law, all earthly law, we are not of this society. But we have to live in it. We have to bring our children up in it. And I think that the two things I'd like to do this afternoon, one is to reassure you that the standards that we are upholding for our children and our families are standards that can now be scientifically supported and proved to be the best way to bring up children. And when we look at these, I think we must say to ourselves, but how is it that this society, in spite of all the scientific evidence we have, why is it that they're passing laws that are actually harming our children? Now, because I'm a children's specialist, I've been very much involved in the whole of this area now for a long time. And when I first got through my medical course and decided I wanted to be a children's doctor, that was, the war broke out just about that time, and I found myself married a little earlier than we intended to, because my husband was going straight off into services, so that my first practice of medicine was in a country town with a baby to look after. And I found myself with a great many women whose husbands had gone to the war, many women who had moved out of the city for the safety of their children and families, a great many women who had been evacuated down from the east because of the war, and here I was with a young baby, and they were tending to come to me because they knew I was in the same position. My husband was away, I was looking after children on my own and so on. I always think it was wonderful preparation for the present situation where I'm seeing so many unmarried mothers and so many supporting parents and so many abandoned wives and so on. And this made me realise what they wanted to know most. These women cared most about their children. They were thinking about the future. They all wanted to do the best for their children. But some of them had some pretty strange ideas about what was best, but still, they wanted to do the best. And as I worked with them, I found they wanted to know more about nutrition and more about sex and more about care of children. And these were things which were not normally in our medical course. There's not much in it now, but there's a bit more. So that I came out of that experience quite convinced that if I got really involved in health education, that I could work in hospitals looking after the sick children, but I could do preparation for parenthood classes, and I could help people prepare for the birth of their babies, and I could teach them a lot about nutrition and a lot that I'd learnt about child development. And I thought all you had to do was to go out and tell people the best way to do things, they'd do it. But of course, I soon discovered that didn't work. That led me to get very involved in the women's movement generally, because it was quite apparent to me that if we were going to look after children properly, and children are the future, I mean, these children that are in high school now are the children that in 10 years' time are going to be, if not actually ruling the country, they are certainly going to be having to support a good many of us. They may not appreciate that, particularly when they've come up in a generation which taught them that abortion was a good thing. And the next step to abortion, of course, is euthanasia. And we hear a great many young people now saying, why should all these old people be living into their 80s and 90s and us have to support them? So that I think we've really got to look very hard at what they're learning in school and learning from the media. And we've got to say to ourselves, have we got a job to do as Christians in this society? If nobody else is telling them what is the best way to live, and we know the best way to live, then we have a responsibility to prove to them that scientifically what we're saying is correct. Now, I know I get very depressed about this at times, and sometimes I wonder whether I'm really right. I think you all feel this at the time when you feel yourself absolutely surrounded. I was saying to my husband as I came up this morning, yesterday I saw two little children of two. Their mothers, both children have been in hospital and I've looked after them, and their mothers, both mothers are enormous great women, huge. Quite unattractive, both unmarried mothers. One has four children, and she's actually been a local prostitute, but she's now living with someone regularly. And the other woman also has a child, unmarried. And these two women now are sharing a house. And I said, how do you come to be sharing a house? And they said, oh, well, we don't know each other. We weren't friends or anything, but our boyfriends knew each other. So they all moved in together. So here these two women are now living with men. Neither men are the fathers of any of the five children that are living in the house with them. Both women are on the supporting mother's benefit. We're paying for this. And they have been all the time. And as I was coming up to my husband, I said, well, look, what was their alternative? They're very unattractive women. They've got very little intelligence. They really need someone to help them and look after them. And if they get married to either of these men, they lose their supporting mother's benefits. So what they chose what was best for them. It gives them a way, it gives them a satisfactory home, at least from their standards. It gives them clothes, and they keep their supporting mother's benefit, which is quite a good one. And they can walk out at any stage, which they do periodically. And so perhaps that's really best. What was the best? And then I began to think of those little children that I've seen in and out of hospital and think, what sort of future have they got? What really they're going to grow up with? When we got these women out of their surgery yesterday, I said to Sister, for goodness sake, there's something about this room. I can't stand the smell any longer. So out she went and got the aerosol and sprayed the whole room and we got on to the next patient. But, you know, really, that is what's happening to so many children. Here we are, our society is actually supporting that way of life for those children. And there's no question about it that those women naturally manipulate the society and choose from what the society has to give them. All I can do is to help them to look after those children a bit better. And I was chatting away to one of them for quite a while, and after a while, she felt, you know, I'd got to know her quite well, and she said, you know, I got my tube sewed last year, and I said, yes, I remember that. And she said, well, the man I'm living with now thinks he'd like a baby. Can I get them undone? And of course, she's not married to him. It'd be another supporting mother's benefit, and it'd be a very expensive operation. So I said, well, I don't really advise it, but you can go and talk to Dr. So-and-so and see. But you see, this is the sort of thing that's happening all around us now. So, can we blame these women? Look at our society generally. In the last, since the Family Law Act, which went through in 1976, in the first 6 years of that act, 330,000 children were involved in divorce. It's an awful lot of children. They lost their home. They lost a parent. Because they lose their home now because the home usually gets sold up and is shared between both parents. So they lost a parent, they lost their home. They see, most of these children might see a parent once, the other parent once a fortnight or once a month. And you can't be a parent unless you live with a child. That's the thing that sort of doesn't register with a lot of people. You see, what the family does, it provides the heredity, it provides the environment in which people are going to live, but more than anything else, it provides the model for living. Children learn by copying. I love the stories that your conductor told about how the child said that you'd said that you were going back to see the butcher. I've heard many examples of this, how children learn by copying. They learn by what you do, not by what you say. So it's that model for living. Various patients have told me stories, similar sort of stories. I remember one of a woman who got onto the bus with a small boy, and she paid one fare, and the bus conductor said to the little boy, how old are you? He said, 4. And he said, when do you turn 5? He said, the minute I get off this bus. And that's, it is so easy to realise that children are taking in the way we're living, the way we're speaking, the way what we're saying, so that the family is actually providing the model for living. And in that model for living, the children are also learning what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman. And that has become very confused. If we have a bit of time to talk about the sex discrimination bill, you really will see just how confused, because one of the prime aims of that bill is to abolish the stereotype of men and women. And that sets down quite firmly in the bill that there's to be no distinction between men and women in any area, except in the unavoidable physical ones, such as pregnancy, and a woman is protected in that by having her job protected and being paid during it. See, it really discriminates in favour of the women there. So that we have a society then that is abolishing this difference. And yet it's in the family that the child learns what is a man and what is a woman. And sex identification depends on understanding those differences. You see, a 3-year-old is beginning to sort out which sex it is. By 18 months, some children know, but most know by 3. And it depends on whether they've had a satisfactory model, whether they're able to get their psychological sex and their physical sex the same. There are some other factors, but this is the main one. And then if that's a bit shaky and they find that that relates to an absent or an ineffective father, not to the mother, but to the type of male relationship the child's had, both boys and girls, and if that's gone wrong, then when they reaffirm their sexuality at about 14 or 15, then they more or less get it fixed as to whether they got their psychological sex right. So that it's not only just standards and morals and hygiene and what you learn about food and all those things you learn from the model for living, but you also learn your sexual identification in the model for living as well. Now, we have people like our Minister for Education, Susan Ryan, who's quite firmly saying that there should be no difference at all between men and women, and that she's going to see that an equal number of women get into jobs as men and so on. Well, we've got to say to ourselves, who then is really going to do the day-to-day care of the children? Now, I looked up, we have a very good psychiatrist who comes and talks at our paediatric meetings, who's always impressed me very much, Dr. Helen Connell. I don't know if she's a Christian. She could be, but I don't know. But I remember at one of her meetings not very long ago, she started her talk in this way. She said, no one would deny the association between the well-adjusted child and a happy, stable family, nor the numbers of behaviourally disturbed children met in clinical practice who are to appear to be the result of inadequate and deviant parenting. Now, over and over again, we've got this through the psychological literature now, that the stable, caring family gives the child the best possible preparation for the future. But our problem is, what about all these influences that are coming in from outside? The laws that have been changed, the fact that this is very much being brought right into education, right into the schools, because people know that if you really want to influence the next generation, you've got to capture the children. That's what Hitler did, it's what the communists have done, it's what every group has done that wants to alter the next generation, indoctrinate the children. So that here we are with our children in schools that are receiving a secular education. Now, I've just got a list of... I've pointed out to you that over 300,000 children are already involved in a divorce situation just in the first 6 years of the Act, that our abortion rate is somewhere between 60 and 80,000 a year, and the Family Planning Association is doing a lot of the sex education in the schools, in the personal development programs, and their philosophy is very clearly and directly in favour of abortion and not in favour of the first sexual experience being within marriage. Many of you probably saw this article in the Herald last week on the first involvement with a sexual experience. And we have the head doctor in the Family Planning Association, Dr. Weisberg, who says that the first experience is usually not a pleasant one, as she says. And she points out that she says her advice is, for the first time, take your time, find a place where you can be relaxed or where you won't be disturbed, and go slowly. No mention of marriage, no mention of a lasting commitment, no mention of love. And there are a number of other quotes here from people in the Family Planning Association. So children coming through many of these programs are just going to be presented with this sort of material, and you're going to be regarded as hopelessly old-fashioned. So that that's the material that they're getting there. There are a lot of very subtle ways in which the language has changed. So I've got a few samples of this that I think you'll recognise as having happened. These are different words whose meaning has changed. Now, you don't often hear anyone say she's a nice, modest girl, do you, these days? Modest is a terribly old-fashioned word. In fact, if you do use the word modest, people will say you've got a sex hang-up. And that's the general way it's referred to. What was disgusting and of bad taste is now spoken of as adult. What was selfish and self-indulgent is now spoken of as self-fulfillment. It's a do-your-own-thing society. What was living in sin is now having a meaningful relationship. Well, the Institute of Family Studies, that is the body who advises and studies the Family Law Act, they refer to it as informal marriage. It's rather interesting. I was listening to news this morning in which some magistrate in Tasmania had refused to accept the term de facto wife in his court. He said a wife was a married person, that de facto wife was the terms were wrong, and they could refer to this woman as a concubine or a mistress if they wanted to, but he wasn't going to have her called a de facto wife in his court. And the news reporter of this morning's paper was most indignant about this. He says, well, that's really wrong. De facto wife is quite all right. And apparently an article in the Telegraph this morning supporting it. So that this whole term, de facto wife, is just accepted. Now, what were talked of as perversions are now referred to as sexual preference. Now, whenever you hear that term, sexual preference, it now refers mainly to homosexuality. It means your preference is sexually is for a person of the same sex. And yet a lot of people think it just means something to do with discrimination against women. It's not. Now, what was depravity is now creative self-expression. And we see it on films, we see it in videos. Look, the children now can get these X-rated videos and pornographic videos. They can go into anybody's home, and children are very curious. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if one or two of you haven't sneaked in to have a look at one in some of a neighbour's house, because you do just wonder what's in them. And these films are now widely available, and they do have a very stimulating effect on children and gradually break down these standards that you're trying to teach them. These films are now, video films are legal. They can be imported legally. And there's very little restriction on their use. The government's taking the attitude, the state, federal government is taking the attitude that it's up to the parents to control the use of these films. Well, there isn't a hope in the world. You know very well that the people who decided we're not going to have a television set in our house, we're going to keep all that away from the children, soon found they didn't have their children at home. They were all in next door or somebody else, or they were out playing with little so-and-so, but when you came to check up, they were all in his house watching television. So that we simply can't do that. Now, any suggestion now that men and women might be different, you just get howled at and get called sexist. Now, I'm a doctor, and I know men and women are different. I know a lot of reasons, anatomy and physiologically, but there's no way we can convince the extremists in the women's movement. Now, any society to survive and hold itself together has to look after its children properly. Now, I've got a report of a study here that I think would interest you and perhaps reassure you. In Britain, for many years, there has been an institute of child care, the National Children's Bureau, it's called. And the head of that has been a Miss Pringle. And she ran it for all 20, 25 years or more. And when she finished, when she retired, she produced this report, a summary of her work, on how she saw parents and children. And she made three main points, and I'll read them out to you because I think they're important. She said, modern parenthood is a demanding and complex task. Young people who've grown up themselves deprived of adequate parental care and not having opportunities to observe and experience first-hand good parenting skills have little chance of becoming responsible parents. Now, that's the thing I think that frightens me when I see all these children growing up in single-parent families, particularly with unmarried mothers. It's very, very difficult to cope as an unmarried mother. When I think of those two little children I saw the other day and realise what their model for living is, and here, after years and years of working with families, she says, these children have very little chance of being good parents. Then she says, in a largely man-made, male-dominated society, homemaking and child rearing has traditionally been assigned a low status. However, the necessary and justified aim of the women's movement has been to raise consciousness and improve the personal identity of women. It has, to a very considerable extent, led to further devaluing of mothering and a misleading, biased portrayal of young children. This deprives many a young woman of a sense of joy and achievement when she creates a nurturing and happy environment for her family, because she's made to feel that she's wasting her abilities. Young babies are presented as mind-blowingly boring rather than engagingly individual. And she points out that because of the extremists in the women's movement, the whole business of looking after home and looking after children and enjoying children and working with children has been made to seem boring and waste of time. Mainly, of course, because it's not paid. Now, a third one is, in Western society, there is no adequate substitute for the one-to-one loving, mutually enjoyable relationship which is the essence of maternal care during the first year of life. However, this does not imply that mothering should be carried on single-handed, or that it cannot be shared with fathers, family and friends, playgroups, and part-time group care. She really points out that that first year, I wish she'd said the first 3 years, I'm quite convinced that it's the first 2 years that a mother needs very close association with her child if she is going to form a satisfactory relationship. I'm seeing all this now, I've lived through it, and I'm now looking after the second generation of children, you see. So that I've seen these girls who've gone straight back to work. I've seen all these wretched school teachers who dump their kids after 3 months or a year and are back teaching school again, bad-tempered and cranky with their children in school and having left their own child at home, and they're back to me with their adolescents, wondering why they can't talk to them and why their adolescents won't relate to them. And I'm seeing so much of this now. So I'm sure she's very right about that. That first 2 years is a terribly important one, but it can be shared. So you see, I'm a great enthusiast for part-time work for women. We're educated. We've all been brought up with some sort of training. And we all want to be able to contribute financially to our homes in some way. I mean, after all, it has been pointed out that with all our labour-saving devices, we have the equivalent of hundreds of servants in our homes that our great-grandmothers didn't have. And naturally, we want to get out more, to keep the talents we have, and to contribute financially to our homes. And most of the young women coming up now are going to want to keep their skills, and they're going to want to do part-time work. Yet our society is saying to them, you cannot leave the workforce and come back after several years. What they're saying to them is, you take your maternity leave, you come back straight, and we'll hold the position for you, but you've got to stay in. And I don't blame these school teachers. It means $4,000 or $5,000 to them to come back. But it's wrong, it's a bad system. And we should be saying very clearly, it is a bad system. That our women want part-time work. They don't want, I've got women who are working the whole of the weekends, getting double pay and triple pay. And this system is quite wrong. And here we've got the extremists agitating for 24-hour childcare. We've just got two 24-hour childcare places set up in New South Wales now. And we, I think, should be saying, but look, we've got the evidence to prove that women should be able to enjoy their children, they should be able to care for them, they should be able to come back into the workforce, yes, but they should not come have their positions held and come back at the same standing. If we're going to have children, we've got to be prepared to give up something, and we do want to come back and do part-time work. But why should all the men's promotion be held up? Why should the single women's promotion be held up to allow women to step out for a while and come straight back. I've got school teachers who are having their third child now on maternity leave, and they've only taught for 3 months in the whole time. They plan them very carefully, you see. They can have a year off. They get their 3 months paid, and then they can have the rest off without pay. And then I've got one girl at the moment who's just due to go back, and she says, I'll be getting pregnant just as quickly as I possibly can, because I don't like leaving my baby. I pointed out, you know, we're paying for it. But she said, oh, well, you know, that's the system, and so I'm getting pregnant as quickly as I possibly can, then I have another year's maternity leave, and I'll be able to have time with this child and the new one I'm having. And that is what our system is doing. Now, it's bad for the children, it's very bad for the mothers. And is it something that we as Christian women should be speaking up about? Because we are paying for it, for one thing, and we're seeing children, I think, being harmed. Well, that's what Miss Pringle says, and I think that supports very strongly what we believe. And it always amazes me that we've really said so little about it. You know, I've got the statistics here for supporting parents' benefit. In 1974, it's not very long ago, just 10 years ago, there were 26,286 women receiving a supporting mother's benefit. In 1983, 9 years later, there were 139,014 receiving a supporting mother's benefit. Now, that is because the Family Law Act specifically says that when a marriage breaks up and there is to be an allocation of funds to see how people where people's needs are greatest, that account must be taken to the fact that the supporting mother's benefit is available to the parent who has to look after the children. So I've got women whose husbands are doctors, whose husbands are lawyers, living on the supporting mother's benefit, because that's what the court did to them. Now, in some cases, of course, the father is paying private school fees and a few things like that, but the mother is actually managing on supporting mother's benefit. That same Family Law Act said that women are not to men and women are not to receive any maintenance when a marriage breaks up. The maintenance is money to go to care for the children, but if the mother or father who has the care of the children is capable of work, then they've got to go and get work. It completely ignores the fact that there is such a role as a mothering role, a homemaking role. So that a woman loses her husband and has to proceed to be homemaker, look after her children, everything else, and expected to work as well. That's what these laws have said. Well, I think that we, believing as we do, and from our biblical teaching, making it very clear that men and women are of equal importance in the sight of God, but our roles are different. And women have got the primary role of the caring and rearing and protecting of children, and men have the primary role of providing. Now, that doesn't mean the women can't provide too, and it doesn't mean the men can't do the caring too. It's made very clear in read Ephesians, very clearly it says there that fathers must not offend their children. And it says very clearly that a husband must love his wife. There's no domineering role there. It's a role of protecting and providing primarily, whereas the mother's is of nurturing and caring for the young child. Now, those roles should still be supported in our society. They've changed very much, because our young women are going to work and want to. Our children are being influenced by the television and the media. And you've just got to watch the media, you know, to see how completely against our ideas most of the media presented is. You've just got to sit through. I often say to people, well, look, just imagine you're a six-year-old and sit in front of the television from about 6 o'clock through to about 10 o'clock. You'll see two or three violent murders, probably. You'll certainly see a few people hop into bed with each other without any mention of marriage or any such relationship. You'll see very little about real child care and real loving relationships or any self-sacrifice. Well, why is this happening? Is it because we're such an uninteresting crowd and can't get our story across? I sometimes think it is, you know. I think that the society generally tends to look on us as a pretty dull lot that don't do anything exciting or interesting at all. I don't think our joy is very obvious. You know, I love old Colonel General Booth. Remember, he used to say he wasn't going to let the devil have all the good tunes. So he got lots of good tunes into his hymns. And I think that the public too very often don't see us actually living up to our principles. Many of us tend to keep our religion in one compartment and our lives in another. It's awfully easy just to go along with what society does. And I think there's a little text in 2 John somewhere which says very clearly that nobody has seen God, and the only way for the public to see God is through the way Christians live and the standards that we live by. So we've got to show ourselves as a joyful, caring people. Now, there's an Ogden Nash verse, if I can remember it, that says, we would all be in less danger from the wiles of the stranger if our own kin and kith were more fun to be with. And I think it's a very important one. But how are we going to influence society in general? We've got to be in the mothers' clubs. We've got to be in the parents and citizens. We've got to be in local government. We've even, in some cases, got to stand for Parliament. I tried. It wasn't very successful, but I tried. And Fred Nile looks as if he's got Jim Cameron in with him this time. So there'll be two of them up there in the upper house fighting away and putting up the Christian principles. We were told there aren't going to be an awful lot of us, that we're going to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world, that sort of thing. But salt's a very interesting substance. And the world's very against salt at the moment, as you're probably realising every time you listen to a talk on nutrition. A little bit is a very good thing. A lot of it is terrible. So that this undiluted Christianity that we sometimes try to impose on people is not acceptable at all. But the pinch of salt that comes into every meeting that we go to, whereas we firmly stick by our standards, could alter the world. And I think it's essential that we do it. Now, I haven't said very much about the sex discrimination bill, and I think your afternoon tea is due, isn't it? Right? Afternoon tea, I'm due? Good. Well, I think that there are two particular bills of interest. There's the anti-discrimination bill and there's the family law bill, about which you all ought to know something. I think you also ought to know that a great many of these modern psychologists who are lecturing in universities are very much on the extreme of the women's lib approach and are very much trying to change the role of men and women. We must accept that there is a change in role, but we've got to be very clear what the differences are. So I think that perhaps during this next session, while you're having afternoon tea, you might chat away to each other and decide what sort of points you think we ought to work on. Do you want to talk about what we ought to be doing? Do you want a bit more clarification on some of these laws? Do you want to say to me you think I'm quite wrong on a lot of issues? So I'd be happy about that too. So that I think that perhaps after afternoon tea we can go on to questions and you can bring them all up. Is that it? Good. Well, I hope you've all thought up your questions. A couple of people have said that they didn't hear me terribly well, so if anyone can't hear at the back, would they please signal? Also, my medicine is better than my theology, so I'd rather you asked medical questions or questions or perhaps some legal ones. So here's the first question. Well, the question is, what place is there for Christians with this new science of in vitro fertilisation, and should we have an attitude to it? Well, first of all, you know, the process consists of fertilising an ovum outside the body. For some time now, we've had the process by which a sperm can be artificially introduced into the uterus and fertilise the ovum in the mother's body. But now we have the process where an ovum can be taken from the mother and fertilised outside the body with a sperm and brought to the, I think it's about the 8-cell stage at several days, and then implanted in the mother's uterus. And she is prepared for the pregnancy by being given hormone injections, so that she's got into the state of being pregnant, being ready to carry an ovum through pregnancy. She's got into the early pregnant state from the point of view of her hormones. Now, this is being used when a woman has been unable to get an ovum fertilised. That usually means that her tubes are blocked and that the ovum can't get down the tube into the uterus to become fertilised. This usually is a result of previous infection, quite often a venereal infection. In some cases it's because she's had her tubes tied because she didn't want another pregnancy and then remarries, as quite often happens now. And in some situations it's because she's been on the pill too long and is having trouble getting into a normal cycle again. Those have been the three commonest causes. But there are, of course, other causes where people have congenitally blocked tubes and have not been able to get pregnant at all. So, this offers a way for a husband and wife to have a child who would not be able to conceive one normally. So as far as I'm concerned, I think that where a husband and wife have not been able to conceive a child normally, I see no objection to modern science enabling them to bear their own child. I feel quite differently about the use of sperm that is not the husband's sperm. Now, that of course has been widely used in artificial insemination up till now, where the mother could conceive but the father was sterile. And so that they've been using sperm from sperm banks. Some of you probably saw that television on the other day of the woman being interviewed who has been using sperm from a sperm bank of Nobel Prize winners in America, and she has one child by a Nobel Prize winner and she's choosing to have the next one, and she's persuaded a friend of hers to do the same so the children all have the same father and it'd be lovely. Well, I can quite see her point, but she's going to have some explaining to do. There's some legal problems here yet, because these children have not really been legally made the children of the parents who've had them. I think Christians have some problems with artificial insemination, though I can still see that there'll be Christians who feel, well, if we can't have our own child, at least we'll have a child that comes from one of us. And we know the sperm has been carefully selected. So I don't think that we can say there is a Christian doctrine on this. I'm entirely in favour of one aspect, but very uncertain about the other. About frozen embryos, that presents another problem, because it means an embryo can be kept and used years later and sort of come into another generation. Well, it's one of those miracles of science, isn't it? And the first frozen embryo has been born now and is a normal child. And the fact that that woman has another one kept, I think that's a woman who has another one kept, that she can now have without going through all the business of having an ovum removed again, you see. So I think there could even be situations where the frozen embryo is going to be all right, provided the whole situation is carefully controlled. I think at present it's just not legally controlled enough, and I'm pretty unhappy about artificial insemination, the way it's being done at present. Any other? This is the question is, what about the situation where you have two such children of the same father who later meet and marry and don't realise that their children are of the same father? This does present a very definite problem. What is being done mainly at the moment is the sperm's only being used three times, and that most of the centres that are doing this are trying to see that those well move areas well apart. You know, they are aware of this problem and are trying to avoid it. There certainly are others that are, because it's not properly legally controlled, some are using sperm too frequently. And, I mean, when we hear about this Nobel Prize winner's one where she's going to have a second one for the same father and she's got a friend who wants another one by number 29 or something, you know, I mean, there seems to be, the whole business is not properly controlled at present. I think there are risks. Now, the other thing about it that might make it a bit safer is at least these are selected donors, at least they're healthy people, their history's been gone into reasonably well, and on the whole, they're probably better genetic material. There's also a very interesting study that was done some time ago in Britain where they typed all the children in one street and all the parents in one street, and there were an awful lot of the children that couldn't belong to the parents. So there'd be, you know, a fair mix-up already, and they decided that statistically the risk was much less of getting those two children of the artificial insemination together than of two children in the same street. So, you know, I think we really have to be sensible about this, but we've got to say that we do believe in Christian marriage, that as far as possible, husband and wife should have their own children, be committed to their own children, look after them. And I think that it's then up to their doctor and their minister and so on to talk out the other situations. But they should be much more better legally controlled than they are. I know of one woman who's got an artificial insemination baby, and the marriage broke up when the child was six. And he firmly believes, of course, that the man she was married to was the father, and then he suddenly gets told, no, it's not his father, and she's not going to see him anymore. And she won't. So the child's absolutely heartbroken, the man's absolutely heartbroken, and they've got no legal comeback. So that these are situations that have to be clarified. Does that answer all you wanted to know about it? Or do you want to ask something more? No. Well, the argument there is that though we say, yes, this is a human being from the time of conception, I think we must also realise that in the normal situation, a great many embryos that are fertilised early just miscarry without us ever knowing. Others miscarry at a month or a few weeks, you see. So that, again, it's not as dreadful as it seems. They've never been implanted, so they could never survive. They're suspended life, and until they're implanted, they can't survive. Now, there are many Christians who believe that it's not a human being until it's implanted with a chance to live. There are other Christians who say that it is a human being from the time of conception. And we have not got biblical guidance on it, not so far as I know. There again, I think that the question is, as the sperm is produced by masturbation, isn't this sinful? Certainly, a lot of Christian people will say yes. For that reason, they've got to disagree with the whole process. I think a great many other Christians would say no. The biblical guidance, I don't think, is clear on that. I think that most people would agree that in sexual intercourse anyway, there's a considerable amount of manual stimulation very often, which is perfectly acceptable. And that this is no further away from science than the whole business of fertilising an ovum outside. You know, it's a carefully controlled scientific procedure. The worrying thing about it is, though, that it is turning out that a number of the women who are carrying the baby like this are having fantasies about father that it might have come from. So I think what we've got to say is that the people involved in this should be very carefully selected. They have to be very sure about what they're doing. They have to have thought it right through. They have to understand the whole process. And that it can be compatible with one's Christian beliefs. It's very different from just masturbation for pleasure, which is in turn sexual stimulation of one person. You see, it's purely sexual performance that one person does by themselves with the purpose of physically stimulating themselves. The purpose of producing the sperm is different. So I think there are two arguments there, and I don't think we can dogmatically say that it would be wrong. Now, for some people, it's completely unacceptable, and as far as they're concerned, that is the decision they come to. So I'm not quite sure if I understand the question. You're bringing up the whole question of organ transplant, are you? Whether it is right or wrong to receive an organ from another person. Or for one person to donate to another. Here again, there are many situations in which we have not got biblical guidance. Now, you realise the stand that the Jehovah's Witnesses have taken, because they don't believe you should transfer human blood, which is another organ, you see. And for that reason, they can't accept that. Now, it seems to me that we've got many advances in science that have enabled us to give life to people that would not have been able to have it. The miracles of science have enabled us to give health to people that would otherwise not be able to have it. That many of the people who, for instance, will get transplants might be people who've been born with an abnormality which could have been caused, by the mother in the uterus, all sorts of reasons, but are not the cause of the person who actually has that condition. So, as far as I'm concerned, here again, I think that organ transplant is that there's no Christian objection now, either to give or to receive. Where the real problem lies is in the these organs have to be transplanted when the person is still theoretically alive. You still have to have a live organ, so that it's determined on brain death. Once a person's brain is dead and can no longer function, but you can preserve their circulation and therefore preserve the organ, that organ should be available for somebody else, if that person who died or their close relatives agree to it. And that would be the situation that I would have, that I can see no objection to organ transplant. I have the strongest objection to brain transplant if anyone ever tries to do that. But otherwise, I think the others. Jim, would you agree with that answer? I've got my medical husband down the back who can check on.
I think what you said about blood transfusion is really important. Most people would accept that and have doubts about the other ones. Mm-hmm. And yet, a blood transfusion is an organ transplant. Mm-hmm. Same challenge.
That's cool. This is we're very particularly interested in this because our son is a hematologist at North Shore. So he's become very involved in this, and of course for a long time he's realised all the awful things you can have in your blood and transplant to somebody else, including AIDS and all sorts of things, you see. So the Jehovah's Witnesses think he's wonderful. But he goes around saying, look, I think blood transfusions are a good thing, but you've got to be awfully careful about them and that they've been overdone. Here again, I think, I hate to say we want more laws, because I shudder at the thought of more laws when I see what we're getting, but we do want either extremely responsible people handling these situations, and maybe it's not new laws, maybe it's very well qualified, reputable medical committees, perhaps with a couple of clergymen on them. Though goodness, I know some mad clergymen, so that I really don't know. But you know, it's hard, isn't it, to say, do we have laws, do we have committees or what? But we certainly want more control. Oh, I know, I served on the Church and Nation Committee, the Presbyterian Church, for years, and we had some crazy men on that. One entirely in favour of the homosexuals, another entirely in favour of abortion, you know, you really... But they were such compassionate men, you know, they told me. What's the next question? This one? The Sex Discrimination Bill was a bill introduced by Senator Ryan, who is a militant women's libber, who was one of the foundation members of the Women's Electoral Lobby. And the aim of this bill, as far as she was concerned, to remove all discrimination against women in all areas. But it is far more than that. That bill also links up with the United Nations bill to remove all discrimination against women, and linked in with Senator Ryan's bill, there's never been any mention of this in the press, but I've got the copy of the bill and I've had to comment on it, all the requirements of that United Nations bill. So that, first of all, we are tied to a United Nations bill, which went through the United Nations, which now is largely dominated by the left-wing members, so that just as with the Tasmanian bill and one in Queensland, these have all linked our laws up with the United Nations. So anything our country, any United Nations agreement that our country accepts, we're likely to get tied to. And the aim of that bill, the United Nations one, was to remove the traditional stereotypes for men and women. And as I explained earlier, the two stereotypes are that woman is primarily the caregiver and nurturer and homemaker, and the man is primarily the provider and protector for his family. That's been the traditional situation. But there's no reason why either can't secondarily do the other. Now, the aim of that bill is to abolish that altogether, so that it sets out quite clearly that all discrimination against women in any positions is to be removed. She has already stated that they're going to bring in quite quickly this special activity to make sure that this is carried out right throughout the country, and it applies to all states. It is going to, it states that women are to have paid maternity leave. It only helps the woman already in the workforce. It doesn't do a single thing for the woman in the home. In fact, it operates against the woman in the home because it provides nothing for her at all. It doesn't accept the role as woman having a special role as mother or caring for the young children. Senator Ryan has already said that one of the essentials in carrying out this bill is to be a considerable increase in childcare services. Now, at present, the childcare services mainly go to the women in the workforce, or a single mother. Very difficult if you're ill or if you get a part-time job for you to get your child minded in any of these childcare centres. So that I think it's going to be essential for women generally to speak up and say, but look, no woman was meant to look after a child 24 hours a day, and that there are times when any family wants their child minded, but priority is to be given to those who are actually in the workforce. The one of the things that worries me most is there's to be no discrimination on grounds of marital status. Now, marital status is defined as married, single, having been married, or de facto. So it immediately equates married and de facto. So no longer can an employer say, I want a married couple. I want a man who is married for this job, or I want a woman who is married for this job. And in many businesses, the employer does want to have a family situation. He wants to feel the clients are going to be entertained and so on in homes where there's a traditional married situation, but he can't expect or ask that anymore. And that, I think, is the most serious thing of all. As far as I'm concerned, it has equated marriage and de facto. Now, we've already had that in the New South Wales anti-discrimination bill. It is also going to mean there can be no discrimination on grounds of homosexuality, not even allowed to ask those questions, according to the bill, so that it alters the sexual standards that we accept. And it does mean that a Christian employer who wants to employ a Christian can't do that if somebody of better qualifications applies. It doesn't only apply to women, of course, if it's a general anti-discrimination bill. So that it does mean that employers are going to have to be very careful how they advertise a job. You'll notice already that the Catholics are now, if they advertise for a job in a Catholic school or any Catholic institution, they state that the teacher must be able to take part in the functions of the church, in the worship of the church. Now, they used not to advertise that, but they do now because they are protected there. The bill does say that in church schools, if there are religious practices that have to be followed, those won't be interfered with. That's the present situation. They've got 2 years or so to think that through, and they may change that later. So that I think employers are going to have to be very careful about to read the bill and know exactly what's in it, or they're going to get caught because of this alteration to the sexual morality in the bill. I think it's the whole business of maternity leave worries me, because I think it is so unfair that if a woman stays home to look after her young children, she gets nothing at all. But if she works the system, she can be well paid. And these are things I think we should be speaking up about. It's not in the best interest of the children, and it certainly doesn't make good mothers out of these women. And the bill, of course, very much supports the system of paid maternity leave. And it's worded so that I think we could, with enough pressure, get it applied to everybody. So either there was some sort of maternity allowance to everyone, or else another way I see around it is that wherever government pays money to anybody, they should have to meet certain requirements. You see, as with the single mothers on the supporting mother's benefit, I think they should have to attend classes on childcare. I think they should have to present their child to the doctor every month and things like this, you know. They should prove that they're earning the money and that they're feeding the child properly. But there's nothing. And I think there are a lot of things here that we could probably speak up about. There are a number of other points in that bill. I've got the thing with me somewhere. If someone asks another question, I'll find the main points from that. So ask another question and I'll find this. What's the best way to make our voice heard? I think we've got a lot of ways we can do it. It's very difficult to do anything by yourself. As soon as you go into a school and start saying something that you don't want your child in the personal development program or anything like this, it gets taken out on the child and so on. You can't do that. You've got to a large extent to work with a group. Now, some of us can get out and talk by ourselves because we're not tied to anything, and I find now that people get back at me, but I can sort of speak up. I think Jim Cameron and Fred Nile can get out. But I think for the vast majority of people, you've got to work with a group. Now, we should all be working through our churches. We should make quite sure that the heads of our churches know what they're talking about and that they do understand these bills. Now, Christian marriage has been abolished legally. It's absolutely abolished. The Family Law Act did that. It turned all marriage into a one-year contract that one person can walk out of. So that is what is civil marriage. So that every minister marrying a couple and every couple getting married at church should understand absolutely clearly the difference between Christian marriage and civil marriage. But I'm quite sure a lot of ministers are not explaining that. You see, I heard a story the other day of a minister tell me how a woman had rung up and his wife answered the phone. And the woman at the end of the phone said, "Do you marry divorced people?" And the minister's wife said, "Well, yes, under certain circumstances." And she said, "Well, has your church got a centre aisle?" And that was really what was going to decide it, you see. Now, so I think we have got to be very clear and work as far as possible through our churches. And we've got to have a pretty clear idea of what is biblical and what is basic and what has just been practices that have grown up. You see, all our different sectarian groups all sort of have different practices, but when you really come down to talk, you find that we've all got the Ten Commandments and we've all got that one that you had up, the law of love. We all accept those and we should be able to work together on all those. I think we can do quite a lot just in our sectarian places, in our schools and so on. But then I think that we have got to influence the law and we've got to influence Parliament. And the way you do that best is hitting people where it costs some money. So that you get onto your local member, particularly if he's in a shaky seat. If he's in a good secure seat, you can forget him and you can go and worry the man in the next place who has got a shaky seat, because they will listen to you and realise that every one of us is a vote. And so it does make a difference to influence your local member. It's not a great deal of use writing to television stations, so it's worthwhile making a protest. It does better to attack the advertiser who's put on the particular program you object to, because it's going to cost their money. I remember a woman telling me once, a story I always enjoy telling, that she said that she'd had several of those horrible programs removed, and particularly the advertisements she objected to that were such erotic sort of things. And she said she wrote in and said that our organisation will not be buying any more of your product till you get that ad off. And she said, "We've got a lot off." And I said, "What's your organisation?" She said, "Me and the woman next door, and we watch our television all the time." So, you know, we can sometimes do more than we think. So we have got, as far as possible, to work in groups and through organisations, and I think we've got to support the known Christian people. You see, one of the problems in this last election, which is quite extraordinary, I find most people don't know which are the Christians standing in Parliament anyway. They're tending to follow parties. They're also tending to say, Fred and Jim are terribly, terribly evangelical sort of Christians. We're not quite as evangelical as that. So they go and vote for Walker. Someone who's an out-and-out humanist. Or support the people on the Anti-Discrimination Board who have actually already recommended that all churches be taxed and all church property be taxed, and that all religion in schools that the Christian religion should be balanced by a lecture in Buddhism, a lecture in Muslim, you know, all these things should be presented equally in schools. That's a recommendation of the Anti-Discrimination Board, you see. So we should actually be making sure that our churches speak up against this. On the whole, the Catholics are doing reasonably well, the Baptists are doing pretty well, but we're not hearing terribly much from all the others. So I think that we could stir up our churches more. I think that probably another terribly important thing is for us to get our facts straight and to know what we're talking about. As soon as you make a mistake, then everything you said is wiped, so that you've got to get copies of these bills, and if you can't get a copy of it, well, at least you ask the senior people in your church to do it. You ask the, if you've got a lawyer in your congregation, you say, look here, you're a Christian, get us the information. And I think we should be using our lay professionals a lot more, because these days we really have to know our facts.
Right. Yeah.
After all, laws can be... the question is, can anything be done about those videos that are now allowed into the country and are legal, the pornographic videos? They are federally through. They're not through the state parliament yet, I don't think. But now that the election's over, I think they'll go through pretty quickly. Here again, I think we've got to make sure that our churches are protesting. We have got to produce evidence that they are being seen. Now, in Britain, a lot of studies have been done, and they say that the majority, now I think it's over 50% of 9-year-old children in Britain have already seen a pornographic video. You know, they're very widely available. I think that we can write to the censorship board. A number of people, I think, writing to the censorship board. I think there is going to be some, they are going to be asked to look at those videos. But I think it's particularly through our churches and particularly through our school parents and citizens groups. You see, you'll hear within the schools that some of these are about. And you can write the education department and object. I think that as the situation crops up, you can very often do something about it. But particularly we've got to work on our members of parliament, because they want to keep their seats, and the more people they find who are objecting to this, they're the ones who can change the laws. And I think that this means that more of us probably should be involved in our party. If we're Labour people, then we should be getting into our unions and into our the groups that select the members and influence the selection of Christian people. So often Christians tend to sit back and say, well, religion and politics shouldn't be mixed. But, you know, religion's everyday living, and politics decides the laws under which we live. So we should be trying to influence them. And I think if we can't convince our ministers, then we've got to convince the professionals, the doctors and the lawyers and so on in our congregations. I know it's not a very satisfactory answer, but it's a very hard one. Someone else had a question over there somewhere. The question is about euthanasia, and the question is, what about a professional working in a terminal hospital who is required to give narcotics that are ordered to be given at a regular period, and this person considers that the doses are unnecessarily big because the pain, they're not entirely being used for pain relief. Very often the aim of giving those is pain relief, assuming that sometimes they're going to be needed for pain relief. You're not implying that these are deliberately given meaning to be for euthanasia, do you? You're meaning that they're given as a regular order, but you're not being specifically ordered to give a terminal dose to that person, though you rather suspect that's what's hoped in the end. That could be. I think most Christian doctors feel that there's a difference between keeping a person alive unnaturally and terminating their life deliberately. You see, there is a difference. Science has given us so many miraculous drugs, and there's so much we can do that you can keep a person alive or their heart still going for very long periods now, and that would be prolonging death in many cases. So that we have to decide a situation really is whether this patient really can live without any of their machinery. Now, there are a lot of people living normal, pretty normal sort of lives with the aid of machinery. You know, the people who are having whose kidneys don't function and so on. So that we have to get that straight too. But Most doctors would feel that we shouldn't be prolonging death, but if we're prolonging life, that's a different matter, and we should not deliberately terminate life. Now, a problem exists where you're working in an institution and you're working under orders. That's what makes it so terribly difficult. You sometimes can say, look, I don't think this dose is, seems to be quite necessary. I'm the person who's looking after the patient all the time, and this person doesn't seem to be having quite so much pain, may I reduce the dose? And it's not very often the doctor won't say, all right, then reduce it a bit and see. You know, because otherwise you're virtually putting the responsibility onto that doctor of giving an overdose, and he knows it can be questioned. The Humanist Society is, of course, pressing very hard for legal euthanasia. And that's the next step to abortion on demand. Now, we've got abortion on demand, paid for by a government. It's paid for and it's completely accepted, and that's what happens here. So that we have a very real danger of facing euthanasia too. And I think we've really got to fight it. But I think in the sort of situation you're mentioning, all you can do is simply to say, look, can I make this dose a bit smaller because this patient person has quite so much pain. May I have it altered to PRN, or may I have a variable dose that I can give as this patient's pain is needed?
Well, I have to give that sort of thing, but it's going to
happen. They won't do it. It's very much back to a personal decision then, isn't it? Sometimes you can go to another person. I mean, often you can speak to the matron or you can speak to the doctor themselves. Sometimes it's even to the relatives.
Oh, it is.
No question about it. Euthanasia is slowly creeping in. And there is no doubt, too, that it is occasionally happening that a child that has, in fact the argument is existing now, whether a baby that has no chance of living very long, these babies are sometimes given overdoses. They certainly have their food withheld. I think all one can do in those situations where you have a child that you know is going to die in a week or 2 weeks, that you could be prolonging death. And that therefore your responsibility is to keep them comfortable, keep them fed, save them from pain, but not do anything to deliberately prolong life, since you wouldn't give them an antibiotic. And those are decisions that doctors have to make. Now, I hope that we'll never have a law on this, because I really do think that it's something that has to be in the hands of responsible medical people, possibly teams, deciding on any particular situation. And maybe in your particular situation the need is for several doctors to get together on this. I mean, it sounds as if there's one doctor who's doing it that is virtually doing a gradual euthanasia, whereas other doctors coming to the same place mightn't agree at all. Is there a chaplain in the place? Well, I would think that would be a fairly easy one to talk to. I think that you'd find that the clergy would be against it.
Well, I think I'd like to interfere somehow, you know, medically and spiritually. Well, I don't think so. I mean, I feel that they're well aware of what's happening.
Well, I don't... I think that if the doctors and the clergy and so on have all come to an agreement in this situation, maybe they have talked it through, and maybe they're working on this fairly carefully. Maybe you could be a little too sensitive to the situation. But I agree with you, euthanasia is creeping in, and it shouldn't be happening in a Christian institution. It'll happen in secular institutions, and I think you can just keep at it, particularly probably through the clergy. Usually it's the women who have much more sense about these things. It's women who value life more, so maybe you've got, is there a Roman Catholic sister in charge of it all? Well, maybe she's the one to go and talk to. Any other questions? The whole question is, What about adoption? What about abortion? Is there abortions of? Are there occasions when abortion is justified? Are there occasions when adoptions just haven't worked out properly? Well, we all know that adoptions at times can work out very badly. I think that they're being better selected and controlled these days. There are mighty few babies coming up for adoption, I can certainly tell you that, very few. And I am firmly in favour of adoption, but there are a number of babies that come up that are really not very good adoption prospects. You know, they've got either nothing whatever about the father, or you're very doubtful what sort of a child this is going to be. And I find more and more I am saying to people, look, don't adopt this child, foster it. And I think we should have a lot more fostering with a view to adoption, you see, in which the people take on the child, they still have government help, they still get a certain amount of money towards helping them, they have medical expenses covered and so on. And I think we should have a lot better fostering system than we have for a number of these children that are going to be poor prospects for adoption. I think the whole system of vetting the adopting parents is now very much better than it used to be. You see, some people used to adopt a child to try and patch up their marriage, which is a catastrophic thing to do. Others would adopt a baby just because they wanted a baby badly, without knowing anything about it. So a lot of these adoptions in the past were pretty bad. But and I find talking to children who are upset about their adoption and want to come and talk about it, that most of them don't really want to meet the natural parents. They want to know more about them. They want to know what sort of people they were, what sort of talents they had, and really what their roots were and where they came from. They want to know that, but they don't want to get back to it on the whole and meet them, unless the family has been, that they've got into, has been a hopelessly disturbed family and has broken up. About abortion, I do think there's a place for abortion. I'm not totally opposed to abortion. I think that it's a bad thing, and I think there are times, though, where you have to choose the lesser of two evils, and occasionally it is better to terminate a pregnancy early, particularly now we know that physically it doesn't do as much harm as it used to. That would be very seldom, and I think the only ones I've agreed to is where I was pretty sure that the fetus was damaged or abnormal, and that this family couldn't cope with it. Now that we can do amniocentesis and detect a lot of the abnormal fetuses in the uterus, that's presented a big problem. And I do say to mothers who know there are congenital abnormalities in the family and are frightened of it, I say, look, you mustn't have an amniocentesis unless you've absolutely decided that if that child's abnormal, you can't take it and it's going to be aborted. And then the whole situation has to be talked out. Now, see, I think there's an occasional situation here where a lot of people have to be involved, but they should be few and far between. They shouldn't be this dreadful abortion on demand that's going on. I struck a woman not very long ago who wanted an abortion because it was going to interfere with her skiing holiday, which was planned for a few weeks' time, and this sort of thing. And they often don't realise the very real risks, that they may not have another pregnancy, that they may end up with blocked tubes. You know, these are the things that are not explained to them. And I do think that the counselling generally about abortion is bad. And this is where I think there's so much criticism of preterm, and I think it's quite right. I don't like these people standing outside upsetting everybody, but I understand why they're doing it. And I do think that there's quite inadequate counselling. You see, very often the people who have psychological problems as a result of their abortion, they don't have it a week after. They're so relieved to be out of the problem. They may have it months after. They may not have it till they've reached the menopause. And then they look back and say, I killed my child. So that the problem can go on, you know, for a very long time. And the counselling should be a lot more thorough than it ought to be, than it has been rather in the past. So I think, yes, there are a few cases where abortion is probably the best thing under certain circumstances. I think we ought to have more fostering of these difficult children. And I don't think a parent... Now, I've got one child I can think of that I saw when it was 3 months and the parents were just putting the adoption through. And I said to them, look, this child has Down syndrome and I don't think you should adopt it. And the parents came and saw me and they said, look, this child is a Down... As you say, it's a Down syndrome. And there's another one that's a better example. This other child was a thyroid deficient child, a child who's going to need thyroid treatment all its life. And this particular one, I told people that this child was going to need thyroid treatment all its life. It was probably going to be possibly a little subnormal, but probably in the normal range, but they're going to have some problems with it. And did they really want to adopt it? And they said, look, a child like this needs a home better than a normal child. So we're going through. And both these people went through with the adoption. Now, the child with the thyroid deficiency, the marriage broke up some years later. Now, and I've had that woman in to see me since saying, look, it's been terrible. It's been worse for this child than any of the other, than her two normal, her own natural children, that the marriage broke up. So it has to be a terribly secure marriage that copes with that situation. And I think people very often need a lot more counselling in these situations. And I think that there's a place for all of them. But as you say, they're not black and white anymore. You can't say, I can't say that no abortion should be done. I can't say that all adoptions are good. I can say most adoptions should be good. There should be very few abortions. You know, I mean, I've come to that sort of situation. This whole question of rapes become terribly difficult. You see, I used to say, well, where a girl had been raped, she ought to just be entitled to an abortion. And then I discovered that that was the commonest argument given for having an abortion, that somebody had raped you. See, it wasn't true anyway. So that there was that problem. Now that... the major hospitals have set up proper counselling services for rape victims. I think the rape victims are getting helped a lot more. I think that business on the media was most unfortunate because it's going to stop an awful lot of girls from reporting anyway. And one of the very unfortunate things about our family law bill, and well, the family law bill particularly, is that it lets particularly the men off their responsibilities. And the more the girls don't report rape, the more likely the man is to go and do it again and getting away with it. So that I think our laws should be applied equally to men and women. I mean, this whole prostitution business, why should all the girls all be prosecuted and nothing ever be done about any of the men? So maybe one of the things about the anti-discrimination bill is it'll remove some of the discrimination there too. There are some good things about that bill, some very good things, but the bad thing is its basic philosophy, just as it is with the Family Law Act. The basic philosophy is no longer a Christian philosophy. I think that this publicity has at least made people understand what's happening a bit more with rape victims. I'm sorry to see the whole thing changed to sexual assault. I felt that that again was not clearly distinguishing between men and women. It was putting men and women in the same situation, and it was much worse against men. I can't answer you very much about that one. It's a difficult one.